Circuit City's trademarks were acquired, and it was relaunched in 2018 with a fully online technology-focused strategy. It's an iconic brand with a rich history, now operating as a tech-driven e-commerce enterprise and steering clear of brick-and-mortar stores. Since its online revival, Circuit City has achieved over $130 million in revenue, is already profitable, and on a path towards a multi-billion dollar valuation. Circuit City's Series A funding round is now open for accredited investors, targeting an over 7x multiplier through a 2028 sale or IPO in U.S. capital markets. To learn more about this exclusive opportunity, visit invest.circuitcity.com. That's invest.circuitcity.com.
You have to take being educated and understand that even though you're a passive investor, you're still an investor, and being an investor is an active thing.
Hello, left fielders. Welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast. Our community is focused on networking and education to help people invest passively and think differently. Let's go.
This is Brian Burke from Praxis Capital, and you are listening to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast.
Really excited today for our guest, Russell Gray. He is a financial and business strategist, co-host of the Real Estate Guys radio show, co-founder of the Syndication Mentoring Club, founder of Main Street Investor Mentoring Club, and recently a new partner with Ken McElroy, George Gammon, Jason Hartman, and Robert Helms in the Collective Inner Circle Mastermind. He's also co-author of Equity Happens. He also happens to be the one that got me started in syndications when I went to the Real Estate Guys syndication seminar and learned more than I expected, and mostly I learned I wanted to be an LP. So, Russell, welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. And so the first question I always ask is if you could kind of take us back and give us your journey. How did you get into real estate and realize that's what you wanted to do? And then how did you become, you know, a guest of this, or a host, I'm sorry, a co-host of the great podcast and radio show that you guys do? If you can kind of just give us the backstory.
Yeah, it's kind of a long story, so I'll try to, you know, keep it as short as possible. And I hope that ultimately it just inspires people to believe that kind of no matter where you're at, where you come from, that you can find a way to live a life that is both rewarding financially, but also lets you do things that you really enjoy doing. I always wanted to be a football coach and a teacher. A history teacher. That's what I wanted to do. But I realized early in life that was never going to pay me. And so I got married very young, right out of high school, moved down to Southern California and apprenticed with my uncle in commercial sales, outside sales in Los Angeles. And that was a little young guy, a boy, basically out there in the big bad world of hustle bustle LA. But I learned a lot. And one of the most important things I learned is the role of a mentor. And not only did he teach me sales, but he said, you're wasting your money by renting. And he encouraged me to buy a property. So I bought my very first piece of property at 19 years old. And I didn't even know what I was doing, didn't really understand. We started a business. And 18 months later, I sold my interest in the business and I sold the property for more money than my wife and I both made working full time together, gross the entire time. And so I discovered equity, I discovered sales, I discovered mentorship, kind of all in the first 2 years of my adult life. Some of the success went to my head and I moved back to Northern California, where I was originally from, with my wife, and went back into corporate sales. And we ended up having children, lots of children. I bought another property, turned it into a rental property. I think the interest rate on my first rental property was like 13 or 14%, but it was positive cash flow. And then I went off and got involved in the financial services business, because I thought that I could make a lot more money in the insurance business than I could in corporate sales. I was selling office products at the time. And then I woke up one day, realized I hated what I was doing. And even though I was a good sales guy and I was working hard, I wasn't making any money because I didn't believe in what I was doing. It wasn't that I have anything negative against the insurance industry. It just wasn't my cup of tea. And so I turned around and I looked at my bookshelf. As you can see, if this is a video behind me, I've got a bookshelf, and all my life I've got books everywhere. I'm just an avid reader. And I looked at all the books that I had on my bookshelf, and they were all about investing in real estate and business. And so I didn't have anything about insurance. I didn't care about insurance. And there was a lot of things that I was involved in doing that I really wasn't interested in. So I thought, you know, instead of asking how can I make more money, I asked myself, what can I do that will, that I'll love doing, that'll pay me to do it? And that began me working on solving this other problem. The other thing I realized is that my real estate made me more money just sitting there doing nothing than I did with all my efforts in business. And so I thought, well, what if I really tried? I mean, what if I put some effort into it? And so to fast forward, I failed in the insurance business. I got back to corporate sales and I started thinking about where I really wanted to be going through this process I just described. And I concluded that I wanted to be a teacher and I wanted to be a coach, but I couldn't do that in the traditional sense. It wasn't going to pay for my family, five children at the time. So I decided to get into financial education. And then the other thing that I thought about is the change you want to be in the world. And I always challenge people in our syndication mentoring program, and anytime I mentor anybody in business, before you think about how much money you want to make or even why you want to make it, I think the first thing you need to think about, if somebody made you God for a day and only one day and you could change one thing in the world, what would it be and why? Because when you can create a business that you have really deep purpose that's bigger than yourself, now you're on a mission. And that keeps you going when the going gets tough. It, you know, it's kind of like you guys were talking before we hit the record button. And I'm saying, tell me a little bit about this thing that you're doing and your business model. And, you know, and it's like, hey, we're figuring it out, but it's basically a labor of love. And I think a lot of people do that. But if you can find a way to monetize a labor of love, and especially if it's, for me, about empowering other people. So my personal mission statement is to empower individual liberty through financial education for effective action. And in 1999, I decided to leave corporate life and get into financial education. And I tried to raise some money through Silicon Valley and decided I did not want a venture capitalist holding my chain. So I said, well, I'm going to self-fund. And I decided to get into the mortgage business because just looking at my very, very modest level of macro economic understanding, what I'd learned is that the baby boomer were a very baby boomer demographic, very powerful demographic working through the seasons of life. And where they were was they were in the equity accumulation phase. So the stock market was booming. And I felt that at some point they would flip over and start moving into bonds for income. This was before bonds had no interest rate, right? So people could actually buy bonds and live on income. And so based on that, I said, well, I'm going to get in the mortgage business because there's going to be a lot of money moving into the bond market. Interest rates will come down. Equities, you know, especially in real estate, will go up. And mortgage business is going to be a good entree into the financial, back into the financial services business instead of insurance. And so I did that. In 2000, 2001, I started working on how I was going to market my mortgage company while I built my financial education business. And I was driving around Silicon Valley and I heard a radio show. It was a real estate guy's radio show hosted by Robert Helms. And he was doing a seminar, how to jumpstart your real estate business. At the same time, I had a young daughter at the time who just graduated from high school. She was interested in real estate and I wanted to show her the real world of self-education instead of going off to college. So I brought her to the seminar with me and that's where I met Robert Helms. And I realized that he had tremendous talent and a lot of potential, but there's some things he needed some help with. And I felt like I could help him, business strategy, organization. And he said that he needed an assistant to help him and his dad in their real estate practice. And so I nudged my daughter and said, go get that job. And so she got the job and I started coaching her on how to fix their business problems. And so they were very happy with her because she was wise beyond her years. And I got a lot of insight into what their business needed. And in time, I proposed to him that we work on building his seminar business into a financial education business. So we did that. 2 years into that, the original co-host of the Real Estate Guys radio show resigned, and Robert asked me if I would be willing to co-host the show, and that was summer of June of 2004, so it was 20 years ago this summer, and that's how I became the co-host of the show. That's kind of how I got involved in financial education. Once I teamed up with Robert, it was a real wild ride. Pretty much everything we touched turned to gold, and it was amazing. Radio show took off. Seminar business took off. My mortgage business took off. His brokerage business took off. We started syndicating and raised millions of dollars. We got the book, the TV show. It was just ridiculous, right up until it wasn't. Then in 2008, everything imploded and I learned a lot. Along the way, we made some good friends like Robert Kiyosaki, and Kenny McElroy, who tried to tell us what was happening and how to position ourselves. But we were really smart back then, so we didn't listen to them. We were still all equity all the time, and we didn't really care about cash flow. We were not recognizing the difference between fundamentals and speculation. And we thought if we got the supply and demand right, we never thought that much about capacity to pay or healthy credit markets or the role that healthy credit markets played in asset valuations, especially assets like real estate that were heavily driven by healthy credit markets. That was way, 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 way too macro for me back then. But after getting my rear end handed to me, losing everything, and I did a show with Mike Maloney a few weeks or a couple months ago, and I told that story, it made me really obsessed with understanding macro. And I spend most of my time teaching more out of the mistakes I made than the things I did right. I think everybody wants to talk about the things they did right. Those are interesting. And there's some lessons there. But a lot is, if I could go back in time and talk to my younger self, what would I do differently? And I spent a lot of time in that space. Of course, along the way, I was able to get to know a lot of really great people. And you've seen them on our Investor Summit. Obviously, the Collective Mastermind, Collective Inner Circle Mastermind that I have with Ken McElroy and George Gammon and Jason Hartman is part of that. Just how can I get in a bigger room? How can I be around smarter people? How can I see a bigger picture? How can I have a broader perspective? You know, not just the real estate echo chamber. How can I see problems happening well in advance instead of having my back to the ocean the day the tsunami hits and not even paying any attention until I'm swept away? And so I spent a lot of time there. And I think that's really more important now than ever before because of the pace of change. We're going undergoing a lot of change. So maybe a bigger answer than you wanted, but that is a basically a 40-year journey that I've been on. There's a lot of other nuances and lessons along the way, but big picture, you know, that's where it's at. The only thing I'll say is after watching my dad lose everything in 1987, based on shenanigans in Wall Street, and after losing everything myself in 2008 because of what really amounted to Wall Street shenanigans, I hate Wall Street. And so a big part of my mission, as you know from attending the Secrets of Successful Syndication, is to defund Wall Street by teaching Main Street how to invest directly in Main Street, which is why I'm a huge proponent of private placement syndication, investing in real assets like real estate, and then limited partners like yourself coming along for that journey. There's no reason for Main Street to go do the real work and earn the real money and then send it off to Wall Street where they gamble with it, put the losses to the public, either through bailouts or through directly, you know, the investors losing their money. And then they get to keep all the upside because they take most of the fees and they send back a small portion. Main Street syndication, a lot flatter. You are investing in things typically that you understand, like apartment buildings or self-storage centers, things that, you know, average people can understand. You have a direct relationship often with the GP and the management team. And I just think it's a lot safer. It's not without risk, clearly, but there's risk everywhere. I just feel like it's a lot more human. It's a lot more Main Street. It's a lot more what this country was designed to be, people helping people, serving each other. I just don't care for Wall Street. So that's my soapbox.
No, I love that. I mean, I'm a former financial advisor who also is not a fan of Wall Street and found syndications partly, as you said, through the real estate syndication seminar that you guys put on. And you know, I went all in, and I've been an LP ever since. And that's all I do. I don't want anything to do with Wall Street either, for a lot of the reasons that you so well articulated there. Now I have a bunch of questions that I want to get to, and sure. That was a fantastic introduction. I really appreciate that. And you know, you've said that we are in kind of the end game of a decades long trend, and there's some major changes. The next reset could be coming soon. So, and you've also said investors who've only been in the game since 2010 or later and don't study history could be caught wrong-footed, like you mentioned in 2008, right? Because we've only seen things go up. I had my own active real estate portfolio, and I made a ton of money, but I was terrible as an asset manager. So, you know, I get that. If you're just looking at the last 10 years before, you know, the interest rates started going crazy, everything was great. You couldn't lose. So what are the trends that you see, and what are these major changes, the great reset? Can you just talk a little bit about that generally?
Yeah, well, the concept of the reset is just that these financial systems and markets, they're bigger than business cycles. Excuse me. They have to do with the fundamentals of the system itself. And so just to go back in time, a little bit in terms of financial history to understand how many resets we've had. We had a very structural reset in this country after the Civil War. It was the first time we ever had an income tax. It was the first time we ever printed a currency that wasn't backed by anything real. Now, both of those things changed coming out of the Civil War, but one of the things fundamentally did not change was the dominance or the beginning of the takeover of the state sovereignty by the federal government. Abraham Lincoln pushed back on states' rights. You see a little bit of that happening today, and the states pushed back, and it erupted into a terrible civil war. But to fund that war, Lincoln instituted an income tax, which was unconstitutional and later deemed so, and they printed those Confederate greenbacks that were worthless eventually because they weren't backed by anything. So those were kind of our first foray. We came out of that and began to get built back up, and our system collapsed in 1907. There was a big financial crisis in 1907, and a guy, not a bank, named J.P. Morgan had to stroke a personal check for $15 million, which was a ton of money back then. Give you an idea, I think we bought all of Alaska for about $7 million. Okay? So I think the Louisiana Purchase was $150 million, and that was like a third of the United States. So $15 million is a lot of money. And so coming out of that, we had a new reset, and that new reset started out as something called the Aldrich Plan, which was basically handing a private cartel of banks a monopoly. There were people who were very, very opposed to it because they felt like it was going to give too much power to a small group of people, which is the fundamental premise the United States was founded to prevent from happening. We only formed the federal government in order to protect interstate commerce, to regulate interstate commerce so states could get along better, and to protect us from external attack. The thing that it's morphed into has really been a process of a series of crises, and each crisis resulting in less personal freedom, less state freedom, and more federal government oversight, to use a polite term. We ended up with the Federal Reserve Act because the Aldrich Plan got scrapped because it was so distasteful. It was named after a senator named Aldrich. And if you've read G. Edward Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, you know the history. They all met in secret on Jekyll Island in Georgia and created this plan to hand over the currency and the banking system to this private group. They did that in 1913. And that was the Great Reset that gave us Federal Reserve notes instead of that are IOUs from the Fed. So we gave the Fed all of our gold and we accepted back these IOUs. And at that time, they were redeemable. 1913. We got the IRS because we got the income tax. So the income tax came back. There was no income tax prior to that one little episode during the Civil War until 1913. And in 1913, the income tax was told as only going to affect a small percentage of the people, and the max rate was 7%. So Main Street, average people, working class people, were never going to pay an income tax. Well, how did that turn out? Camel's nose under the tent, right? Didn't turn out very well. So the IRS, the Federal Reserve, and the income tax were all born in the 16th Amendment, which was the 16th Amendment and then the Federal Reserve Act. That was a big reset. As soon as that got done, we entered immediately into World War I, and we printed a bunch of money. And that money ended up in the economy, and that caused the Roaring Twenties. And so we had 100 years ago, we had a booming economy based on printed money. Sound familiar? And it ended up in a giant asset bubble that ended up in a giant collapse called the Depression. Started with the stock market crash of 1929, and ultimately the pit of the Depression in 1933. And that's when Franklin Roosevelt did the next Great Reset. And that's where we instituted Social Security. That's where we created the SEC. That's where we outlaw gold with private ownership of gold with Executive Order 6102. And we set the table. We basically took all the money from the American people. I mean, we paid them $20. We gave them $20 of Federal Reserve notes. And then immediately revalued the gold from $20.67 to $35. And so now what you could have bought with $20, you needed $35, and they gave you the dollar, so you needed $35. If you had the gold, it would still be worth it, right? So that right away they stole through inflation a bunch of purchasing power. And so that went on for a while. And then in 1944, 45, after World War II, the United States had accumulated about 20,000 tons of gold because the other countries in the world that were drawing upon our manufacturing capacity to fund their war effort were sending us their gold. They were paying in gold. And so we're banking all this gold. Well, then after we came up with the atomic bomb and we won the war, we sat everybody down at a hotel in New Hampshire called Bretton Woods. And we said, hey guys, new sheriff in town, we got the biggest army, we got the biggest bomb, we got the best economy, we got all the gold, here's the way it's going to roll. You can use dollars. Everybody's going to use dollars. It's going to become the new world's reserve currency, taken over for the British pound, which had failed because they spent all their money fighting the war. And we're going to back it with gold. So the dollar is as good as gold. And you Americans can't own gold, but foreigners could. And so we went on that system. Well, the minute we got that system, we started printing money like crazy and eventually started going broke. So we had another great reset. And that great reset happened in the early 60s when we basically were running out of silver. And so we passed the Coinage Act and we took all the silver out of the coin. So we separated now currency, which is a medium of exchange, from money, which is gold and silver. So now we had pieces of paper that we're using as currency that are no longer redeemable for money. And we have coins that are copper, zinc-plated copper, a quarter, has only 6 cents of metal in it because we took all the silver out. And so the way I explain it to people is if in 1965, you took a 1964 quarter and a 1965 quarter and put them both in a sock drawer, both of them in 1965 would purchase 1 gallon of gas. 60 years later, if you pull those quarters out of the sock drawer, the 65 quarter, which was a token, a zinc-plated copper coin, currency, not money, would only buy a tenth of a gallon if you're lucky. The silver quarter would still buy a full gallon of gas because the silver retained its relative value. That's the difference between money and currency. Most people don't understand it. So they save currency thinking they're saving money. And they think money is capital, but it's not. It's a derivative of capital, which is actual production. So many people just don't understand even the way the financial system works. So that was a great reset. And so then once the silver had been basically taken out of the system, and that was a sign to the rest of the world that America had printed too much money under the Bretton Woods system, a guy named Charles de Gaulle, who was the president of France at the time, held a meeting and said, hey, everybody, you know, I don't know if you're paying attention to the United States, but they printed way more dollars than they have gold. And so if you think these dollars are going to be redeemable for gold and they're as good as gold, you're fooling yourself. You better go collect. So all of a sudden, the world is showing up at the window collecting the gold. And we went from 20,000 tons of gold to 8. By 1971, Nixon was then President Richard Nixon goes, you know what? They're going to take all our money. So he closed the gold window, August 15th, 1971. You go to YouTube and look it up, watch him, and he blamed it on speculators and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, the United States had printed too much money. That was another great reset. It was the great default. The result was then the currency, the dollar, everybody knew was not backed by gold. They started turning in the currency and buying gold. So what happened? Inflation went up. It took more dollars to buy oil, to buy food, to buy anything, and the price of gold went from $42 an ounce up to $850 over a period of years. It was this huge spike. That was a currency collapse. But if you didn't understand what was happening, you thought, oh, gold is going up. No, gold isn't going up. Gold is gold. What was going is the dollar was collapsing. And so that's what happened in the 70s. That was a great reset. To fix that, Paul Volcker, a name you probably recognize, stepped in as the Federal Reserve Chair and raised interest rates, not to 5, like Jerome Powell, but to 20. And he reset the entire bond market and saved the dollar. And it was tremendous pain. And the way we replaced that was by going horrifically into debt. And so if you look at the Reagan Revolution, it was a huge run-up of federal debt that we injected into the economy. And so we had a 40-year, decades-long downward trend in interest rates. You can look at a chart at the Federal Reserve St. Louis branch and look at it, and you can see it. And it culminated at the zero bound. They lowered it all the way down to as low as it could be and hit the zero bound and just lay there. And every time they tried to get up off the mat, the economy would collapse and we'd have to lower it back down. Jerome Powell comes in. He says, okay, well, I'm going to jack it up. So this is the thing, Jim, that a lot of people don't understand is the impact of that and what's going on. So that is a long history tour to take you to the current situation. Interest rates are like capitalization rates in apartments. So if you have a real estate investing audience, they should understand cap rates. If the income on an apartment building stays the same and the cap rate goes down, what happens to the value of the property? Goes up. It goes up. If the income stays the same and the capitalization rate on the property goes up, what happens to the value of the property? It goes down. So you understand that, and hopefully your audience understands that an asset value based on a stream of income is going to be inverse of the ROI or the cash on equity. Okay. And so if you understand that, then you understand that when you issue a bunch of bonds, which work the same way, $100,000 bond, say at a 5% coupon, which would be the cap rate, then you put in $100,000 and you get $5,000 a year in interest income on the bond. If the interest rates were to go up by 10%, then that bond's coupon doesn't change. It's still only going to pay $5,000. So if you're going to buy that bond in the secondary market at the going rate, what are you going to pay? If the going rate's 10%, you're going to pay $50,000. So if you're on the equity side of that bond, if that bond's on your balance sheet and you're holding it for $100,000 and you bought it in a 5% world and interest rates went up to 10%, your capital just got cut in half. You might say, well, Russ, what does that have to do with anything? You guys remember this time last year when we were on the early arrival of this rapid spike in interest rates by the Federal Reserve? You remember a little outfit called Silicon Valley Bank? Yeah, they were holding a bunch of long bonds that they'd purchased when interest rates were like 50 basis points. Now interest rates are 5%. What do you think happened to their capital? It dried up, right? Their equity was gone. So now they're like, well, crap, I got to either get a whole bunch more deposits or I'm going to have to raise money by selling stock. And so they went out into the market and they started trying to sell their stock to raise some capital to recapitalize their bank. Well, you know, they're in Silicon Valley. They got a really bunch of smart venture capitalists who understand what's going on. And they know that these companies that they have funded have made their deposits into Silicon Valley Bank. And this bank's in trouble. And so they're working the phones. Hey, startup, you got your money in Silicon Valley Bank. You better get the hell out. Like, we can't. We took a loan out from Silicon Valley Bank. We're out. Take it out anyway. So anyway, all this money goes flowing out. Now they're hemorrhaging deposits. They've already lost their balance sheet because of the rising interest rates. And the bank collapsed. You know, who's going to buy stock in a failing concern? Nobody. So the thing collapses. Well, now the Treasury with Janet Yellen has to step in and go, hey, I know that we only said we'd insure up to $250,000 per account with FDIC insurance, but we're going to insure unlimited. I mean, you had people in there with $150 billion and they got insured. Foreigners, foreign account holders, Chinese companies, they were bailed out by U.S. taxpayers. Okay. So and that hits Main Street. How does it hit Main Street? When your grocery bill goes from $5 for a dozen eggs to $8 for eggs, when your gas bill goes from $2 a gallon to $4 a gallon, right? When you start seeing that, that's the inflation tax paying for this out of control spending. And a big part of the federal government spending right now is its own increase in interest expense based on how many bonds it's issuing. And so now you're reaching this, what I call the event horizon. You know, the event horizon is when, like, if you're borrowing money and in order to pay the interest on the money you've already borrowed, you have to borrow more money. Right. That's the doom. That's the doom. That's the doom loop. And so you have to understand the impact. People say, yeah, but the interest rate's only 5%. And with Volcker, it was 20. We got a lot of room to go. Ah, not so fast. It isn't the rate. It's the rate of change. If I am holding bonds on my balance sheet at 8%, which is what the rates were when Volcker started, and he jacks them up to 16%, he's only doubled the rate. That's bad, but it's only double. When you take the rates from 25 basis points, which is 0.25 point, which is where it was when Powell started this, and jack it up to 5.25, that's a 20 times increase in interest expense. So if you have interest that you have to roll over, debt you have to roll over, like the federal government, and you've been issuing 25 basis point, 0.5 basis point, 1% rates, now you have to refinance at 5%. It's not the 5% that's killer. It's that you have a debt, a stack of debt where you're increasing your debt service, not by double, but by 400 or 500%. And so the financial system is still very fragile right now. People don't realize that the credit markets, which are a derivative of the financial system, are very weak. And this multi-decade, what I call the cascading crisis, if you go back, we did a YouTube series when you mentioned COVID at the top, or maybe before we spoke. I think before we spoke, you talked about COVID. COVID first came out, I said, hey, you know what? I think there's going to be a four-phase cascading crisis. There's going to be a health crisis, which I don't understand, but I'm taking everybody at their word, right? In hindsight, maybe not as big a crisis as everybody thought, but at the time, everybody treated it like it was real, and it shut everything down. So that was causing the economic crisis. When you shut down productivity, people can't pay. And when people can't earn and pay, then you create a financial crisis because debt goes bad. When you create a financial crisis and debt goes bad, like when subprime people couldn't refinance in the 2008 because the equity wasn't there and the interest rates had risen, whatever causes the debt to begin to go bad, now you have the fourth phase of the crisis, which is a currency crisis, because you got to print a whole bunch of currency to paper over all the bad debt and reflate everything. So people that have only been investing since 2010 were investing in the rising tide of a Fed balance sheet going from $800 billion to $9 trillion between 2008, you know, the GFC, and COVID. And that is a whole lot of rising tide getting into a system to raise asset prices. Now the Fed has been trying to raise interest rates, shrink its balance sheet. I just read a report the other day, the M2 money supply is shrinking. These are all going to be downward pressure on asset values, which will be good on the backside if you're in a position to buy things when they make sense by price. I mean, I don't need to tell you as an investor, it's very difficult to find things that actually cash flow well enough on the fundamentals to justify the asset prices. Sellers are like, they're not wanting to admit cap rates have gone up, but they have. And they don't want to let it go. But eventually they're going to get, you know, they're going to have to cash that reality check, and those prices are going to come down. So it's not doom and gloom by any stretch. It's a lot of opportunity coming, and we all can be excited about that as investors. But if you're investing based on a rising tide, I think you're making a mistake. If you buy an asset, any asset, whether it's a stock, a house, apartment building, anything, with the idea that it's going to go up because inflation, it's just going to go up, I wouldn't count on that. What I would focus on, and I don't give financial advice, I just give ideas and information, but I would really focus on income. And if it's generating good income and you can control whatever debt you have on it sustainably for the long term without like a short-term interest rate reset, then I think that you're in a position to be able to withstand. So the resets, there's been a whole series of resets. We've just gone through a great reset calling an interest rate reset, which has reset all asset valuations through the system and stressed balance sheets. The next reset, I think if we have it, is going to be a switching of the currency. We've got an effort by the global geopolitically, with BRICS and BRICS Plus, Saudi Arabia just joining, people trading outside the dollar with the petrodollars, a lot of emphasis geopolitically to de-dollarize. That has a profound effect on Americans who do everything in dollars. And the other thing is, the Fed, who is, I think, trying to get out of this current system, is pushing towards a central bank digital currency, something that Donald Trump recently came out and said, hey, that's not going to happen under my watch. So whether you like Donald Trump or don't like Donald Trump, he definitely has a voice, and at least he's drawing people's attention to it. So if your listeners haven't been paying attention to central bank digital currencies and the potential ramifications, there is a possibility that there is a crisis coming, whether it's accidental or contrived, that is going to create a lot of stress. And the solution that gets introduced might be a central bank digital currency, which would be perhaps the next great reset. Or there will be some type of multipolar reserve currency, not the dollar, which would also be a different type of great reset, which would be very difficult on Americans, because instead of the burden of inflation being borne by all dollar holders worldwide, all those dollars would start to be turned in or canceled out, and the remaining inflation would be borne only by the dollar holders, which are going to be primarily Americans. And I think Americans, you know, if they tracked with what I just said, and it's taken me years to understand this, right? But I watch it like a hawk, and everything's happening very fast. So, you know, you might say, well, how do I stay safe in all of this? I would say just focus on the fundamentals of investing in real assets that produce real income and are valuable to a demographic that is most likely to be most resilient or most supported going through whatever the downturn is, and divest yourself to a degree of reliance upon currency for your savings. And I would consider taking a look at getting into real money, precious metals, for a portion of your liquid net worth, so that you're in, you know, things that are real. You're generating real income, not speculating on asset price changes, and you're insulated both from a financial system reset collapse, if you will, or a currency reset collapse, if you will. And if nothing happens, better to be prepared to not have a crisis and have a crisis and not be prepared.
That's just fantastic. All that, I know, gold, right? That was gold right there that you just gave us.
Russell Capital is an elite Ohio-based private equity firm with a specialization in long-term, high cash flow multifamily investments. If you're looking for long-term recurring income, you should check out Russell Capital. From their approach to managing risk, to the locations they invest, the product quality they provide, this firm is serious about what they do, which is why the owners of Russell Capital invest their money in every deal they take on. Review their case studies by visiting rustbeltcapital.com. That's rustbeltcapital.com. Once again, rustbeltcapital.com, or email investor@rustbeltcapital.com.
Hello, left fielders. At LFI, you know our focus is on networking and education. Mark your calendars, because we're going to have a full day of it dedicated to you, our limited partners, at the Best Ever Conference on April 9th in Salt Lake City. LFI is opening the BEC with passive investing with left field investors, an event focused on passive investors. This will be where insightful content meets passionate limited partners. If you enjoyed BEC last year and the meetup in left field this year, then imagine them both back to back. The Best Ever Conference isn't just any event. It's the premier conference for commercial real estate investors and operators. Your ticket to passive investing with left field investors includes admission to the entire Best Ever Conference from April 9th through the 12th. Join us April 9th, where we will have a packed agenda with sessions focused on how to be a successful limited partner led by experienced LPs, top operators, and partners. Then, immerse yourself in the full Best Ever Conference, where you will be surrounded by like-minded investors, operators, and industry experts for unparalleled opportunities for learning and networking. The best part, and there are so many, but the best part, you won't find a bigger discount on the regular ticket price than the one you get for being an infielder. That's more content for an exclusive lower price. Register for the event today at leftfieldinvestors.com/BEC, and we will see you at Passive Investing with Left Field Investors at the BEC. I want to kind of dig in a little bit on the cash flow, you know, getting income from assets. You talked about the roller coaster economy recently in a podcast, and that to create stability, it might make sense, like you said, to invest for income rather than asset appreciation. You used a great example where someone owned a $5 million property debt-free with no income versus owning a $2 million property with 50% debt and $100,000 annual income. And you asked who is richer, right? And the idea is, if you have income, you know, that makes you richer, right? And so in our community, we have a lot of people who have W-2 incomes coming in And they often, not all of them, but some of them look at it and say, hey, I should invest for appreciation because I already have my income coming in. And then you have others like me who don't have a W-2 income. And so I'm all about the cash flow. So can you talk about, you know, how the focus should be, it seems like, in this stage on income rather than appreciation. So can you drill down a little bit on that? Because I thought that was a great
1,000%. And it's a fantastic question that people need to understand. And I'll just say this, just remember this one phrase. Equity or income is equity. The more income, the more equity. Okay, that's it. In other words, if you have equity without income, you have fake equity. So how do you increase income? I mean, you know, if you buy an apartment building and you've probably been an LP and watch the GPs do this, they buy the property. And the first thing they do is they go to work on improving the NOI. Because they know if they can improve the NOI, they get a multiple back of that in income. Ken McElroy's infinite strategy is that you buy a property, you increase the income, which usually 10x's the equity. If I can increase the income by $200,000 a year, I probably got $2 million of equity. Now I can leverage that income against that equity and pull the equity back out and turn it into something real. I could go put it in gold if I wanted to, if I just wanted to park the equity in someplace safer, or I could put it into equity as a down payment on a new property, repeat the process, and just leave the old property just churning out cash flow. So my point is that you focus on income. Look at Warren Buffett. He invests for fundamentals. He looks for companies that produce that produce real products, that generate real income, that are managed well and generate real profits. And if you focus on companies that operate like that, you wait until the share price is a value for the income it produces. When he buys the stock, he's not buying the stock because he wants the stock price to go up. He's buying the stock because he's getting a good return on his investment in terms of income. Now, he's smart enough to also understand that when other people see what he's seen, they're going to come in and overbid the income, bringing it back to real estate. You get a market that's hot. Somebody is investing in the marketplace, and all of a sudden, people see the prices going up. And I'm just going to use gross rent multiplier instead of cap rates. It's easier for people to understand. But if you have, say, a $200,000 property that's generating $20,000 a year of gross income, then that would be a 10 GRM. If all of a sudden that property is worth $300,000 and the income hasn't gone up, then now the GRM is 15. It's like a rising, a shrinking cap rate, right? Another same income, but the price is going up, right? Now, somebody who's unsophisticated, who doesn't know what they're doing, says, hey, you know, look at this. This property went from 200 to 300,000. I'm going to buy it because it might go to 400,000. Okay, well, if it does go to 400,000, now your GRM is up to what? 20. See, in other words, that's not sustainable because it's not going up based on fundamentals. It's going up on hype. Now, if you had a property that was generating $20,000 in income, and it went up to $200,000 or from 200 to 300. And then you went and looked at it and you said, look at the rents have gone up from 20,000 to 30,000. It's still a 10 GRM. Fundamentally, you've got two properties. Both went from 200 to 300, but one went up for the right reasons and would make a reasonable investment. The other one went up for the wrong reasons and would become a dangerous speculative investment. So if you don't know how to underwrite asset values as a derivative of the income, then you don't know whether you're buying into the hype. You don't know whether the thing's got any room left to run. And of course, in the real world, it's not that clean. In the real world, the rents are rising and people are chasing, you know, just like with stocks and PE ratios, or your financial advisor, you know, people get in front of that. You know, people say, oh, this company just announced good earnings, and so we're going to bid it up from a 20 PE to a 40 PE price to earnings ratio, and then hope the company grows into it. Look at Amazon, ran in the negative forever, but everybody was betting on the future. Well, if you get that bet right, but I was in Silicon Valley in 1999, and for every Amazon, there were 1,000 dot-coms that failed. It's a very, you know, it's a crapshoot, and you just have to understand that's what it is. So to me, if you focus on investing in real income, and then when you underwrite the income, you have to underwrite the source of the income. What demographic is this coming from? What industries is this dependent on? What economic factors? You know, if I say, okay, well, this is great. I'm going to buy this property and everybody in this town has jobs because they all work at the local 8-track set recording factory. It's the only company in town. You might say the income is great. The line of customers out the door, you know, that have jobs and want to compete for the available units is fantastic. But you realize that that's a one-trick pony. And if the technology changes or that factory moves overseas, you're screwed. We had that same situation come up way back in the day. Were you investing back when the Bakken oil field was all the rage?
Yeah, I wasn't involved in that, but I'm familiar with it.
One-trick pony, right? Nobody lives in North Dakota. Nobody wants to live in North Dakota. Sorry, all you North Dakotans listening, but hey, you know, like 20 degree, a lot of people aren't into that. But then they discover oil in the Bakken oil field, and they're like, hey, oil's $140 a barrel, and everybody and their mother moved in, like the, you know, the Great Alaskan or California gold rush of the old 1800s, and they all move in. Now there's a huge demand and no supply and high-paying jobs galore, and people go in there and they start building. And the people who built or flipped, got in, got out, and sold to the people who are going to hold long-term, the people who hold long-term ended up on the wrong end of that deal because, yeah, the income was there. The job demand was there. But was the thing driving all of that sustainable? So underwriting is important, and it's underwriting not just the income and the property and the fundamentals on the property, but the market and the economic factors behind the income, and do you believe in those for the long term? If you do, then it can be a great investment. If you don't, then you want to keep shopping until you find something that is you feel is going to be more sustainable based on where you think the economic winds are blowing.
And how do LPs get there? Meaning, like when we're evaluating an investment, we're finding an operator, we're vetting them. You know, we use our community to vet them to make sure that, you know, we work together to learn and to be better investors. And then we get the pitch deck, and then we got to look at it. And so we're trying to figure out, is this real or not? And are we, you know, how do we know the rent growth assumptions are correct? Yeah, we can do our research and go into the market and find out, but you know, we're at a little bit of a disadvantage as an LP compared to the operator on the ground running the deal. So what is your advice to LPs as far as how do we analyze these deals and make sure that we're not buying on the hype, but we're buying on the one that went from, you know, $220,000 of income to $330,000 of income?
Okay. Another fantastic question. So thank you. This is awesome. Make sure you send me a copy of this interview because I'm liking all this. And I want to make this case to the members of our syndication mentoring club because, you know, passive investors, LPs, if you will, are their target market. And when I train people, I'm saying, hey guys, when you present an offering to somebody, lay out your investment thesis. So lay out the context, the economic context, the demographic context, the argument for why this niche, why this geographic market, why this demographic makes sense, and then drill down into that context and show your deal in that context and educate your prospective investor and help them see what you see. If you can't explain that to somebody, then you got to question whether or not you're making a good investment on behalf of your investors. With that said, the vast majority of people out there who put deals together don't do that depth of analysis. That's kind of institutional caliber analysis. But if Main Street is going to take on Wall Street, we've got to up our game. That's why I train in that area. Now, with that said, when you're a limited partner, that doesn't mean that you are a passive in terms of knowledge, underwriting, understanding. You don't get to be naive. You don't get to be ignorant. What I see in Wall Street is they cater to people being lazy. They cater to people. They talk high level. They don't use real world explanations. They never talk about things they can't explain away in their model, like counterparty risk. You will never hear Wall Street talking about counterparty risk because everything they do is full of counterparty risk. So they never talk about it. They very seldom talk about income because everybody in there is trying to buy low, sell high. It's all about asset price and trends and direction. So they basically cultivate a gambling environment. So if you can't bring that mentality, you know, you're old enough to remember the old E-Trade commercials, the baby with the app sitting in the high chair or the crib, right? I mean, that tells you how they think of their customers. They literally want to encourage you to be so trusting, to be so dependent on their system that you can just use some little app. You don't, oh, I can buy, I can sell, I can trade. You can transact, but do you understand a thing about what you're buying? No, the last thing they want you to do is be educated. So I think that people listening to the show, people who are investing in their education as you have, you came out to our seminar. I mean, there's a lot of great things. You get educated. So you have to take being educated and understand that even though you're a passive investor, you're still an investor, and being an investor is an active thing. Warren Buffett reads 80% of his day. He doesn't run any of the companies he invests in. Maybe on paper, he's a passive investor, but in the real world, he's very active. And so you cannot escape the fact that if you want to take your future into your own hands, that freedom comes with responsibility. And you have to accept it. It's important. There's certain things in life you cannot be ignorant about. You can't delegate. You can't hire somebody to exercise for you, to eat for you, to maintain healthy relationships for you. You can't delegate that. If you're ignorant about those things, then and just expect to go to the doctor or the therapist after the fact and have them fix you up, you're going to have a miserable life. Well, ditto for your investments, right? You cannot afford, you have to understand what's going on in the macroverse. You have to understand what it means to you. You have to understand an investment thesis and whether an investment makes sense. You have to understand portfolio strategy. I'm here to tell you, you can learn it. It's not that complicated. But you're not going to get that education on Wall Street because their whole marketing is designed to make you feel like you're stupid, you're unqualified, that you have to depend upon the people. You were a financial advisor. You know how much training we got. I was one too, right? Not a lot. You learn how to pass a test and not break the law, right? In terms of actually knowing what you're doing for your clients, you know nothing. And then you rely upon the analysts that are basically up there pushing the company book. So it's just a very unsafe place to play. You know, if you don't want to do the work, then just buy gold and cash, you know, or buy something super simple that you understand. You know, it might not be a great investment in terms of ROI or whatever, but go buy a house, go buy the house next door, pay for it, and just let the rent come in and you get it. You get the business model, you're friends with your neighbor, you collect the rent personally. That's not bad. Collect four or five of those in your neighborhood and you'll do fine in life. But if you want to be an investor, if you really want to be an investor, understand these things. And I'll just tell you, I don't have a PhD. I don't even have a degree. I've been on stage with people that have PhDs. I've had conversations with people. I can hold my own. And I learned it all just by reading books, by studying, by going to seminars, by asking questions, and by thinking. And so you can do it. If I can do it, you can do it. And how long are you going to be an investor? If it takes you 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, I mean, think about what you had to do to get a college degree or a master's degree. And you say, well, yeah, I'm going to spend this 6-7 years of my life to learn how to do this, but I'm going to spend the rest of my life doing it, monetizing the education. I promise you an education in investing will pay a whole lot more than an investment in a degree so you can go get a job and be a cog in somebody's machine. You make a lot more money investing if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, well said. I mean, that's fantastic. And I want to be respectful of your time. I could ask you questions all day long, but we don't have all day. So the last question I always ask is, what's a great podcast that you listen to? We are not going to allow you to say the Real Estate Guys radio show because that's fantastic. It's already in the show notes. So maybe give us one or two others that you like.
Well, I'm a regular contributor now to Mike Maloney's podcast. And so if you're interested in kind of the macro and listening, you know, understanding gold and silver, Mike is a data-driven guy and he shares some good information. He keeps it pretty down to earth, pretty understandable. So I enjoy that and I enjoy contributing to that. I'm a huge fan of George Gammon. I think George is another self-taught guy like me, younger than me, heck of a lot smarter, but he really dives into the plumbing of the financial system and understanding what's going on in the credit markets, the banking system, the interest rates, currency. He's not afraid to be contrarian. He interviews a lot of really smart people. So I'm a fan of George Gammon. Those are probably two. I listen to Peter Schiff quite a bit. You know, Peter is a little bit doom and gloomy because he really focuses on what's wrong, but he does understand that the dollar is potentially in trouble and Americans aren't ready for that. He's a proponent of real money, which is gold. I think the thing you want to make sure when you're listening to people who talk to you about metals is don't let them talk to you about it like, oh, it's going to go up in dollars. It doesn't matter. What you want to do is just make sure you have, you measure your wealth in ounces and you have some of it there. I think just look at the track record of gold. It doesn't matter what the currency is. It's always been a good track record. And if the currency changes to CBDCs or something else, it won't matter. You'll have something that's real. So I think Peter's generally been pretty good. If you're into real estate, I think Kenny McElroy's stuff is good. He's very, again, down to earth. I contribute there pretty regularly. So, I'd say those are probably my favorites. Give me the macro view, give me the metal view, give me the real estate view in practical terms.
Awesome. Those are great suggestions. We'll put it all in the show notes. And then finally, if listeners want to learn more about you or the real estate guys, what's the best way to do that?
I actually just set this up. I'm trying to make it a little bit easier because I have my fingers in other pots. But if you just send an email to follow at Russell Gray, R-U-S-S-E-L-L gray.com. So follow at RussellGray.com. You get an auto reply that just tells you all the ways to find me and follow me. And if you don't like it, you can unsubscribe to whatever. But that's probably the best way. That way, wherever I show up, you'll hear about it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Russell. This has been fantastic and really appreciate you being on the show.
My pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Left Field Investors is a community dedicated to limited partner investors who are interested in building wealth through real estate investing. The community is focused on education, networking, and engagement with quality operators and partners. We provide tools, webinars, and a forum where members can discuss everything related to real estate investing, including deals, operators, investment strategies, and much more. Coming soon, we're adding a new tool, sponsor reviews. This will be a place where our members can rate and review operating partners to further help each other in our investment journeys. Check us out at leftfieldinvestors.com. Hello, left fielders. At LFI, you know our focus is on networking and education. Mark your calendars because we're going to have a full day of it dedicated to you, our limited partners, at the Best Ever Conference on April 9th in Salt Lake City. LFI is opening the BEC with Passive Investing with Left Field Investors, an event focused on passive investors. This will be where insightful content meets passionate limited partners. If you enjoyed BEC last year and the meetup in Left Field this year, then imagine them both back to back. The Best Ever Conference isn't just any event. It's the premier conference for commercial real estate investors and operators. Your ticket to Passive Investing with Left Field Investors includes admission to the entire Best Ever Conference from April 9th through the 12th. Join us April 9th, where we will have a packed agenda with sessions focused on how to be a successful limited partner led by experienced LPs, top operators, and partners. Then, immerse yourself in the full Best Ever Conference, where you will be surrounded by like-minded investors, operators, and industry experts for unparalleled opportunities for learning and networking. The best part, and there are so many, but the best part, you won't find a bigger discount on the regular ticket price than the one you get for being an infielder. That's more content for an exclusive lower price. Register for the event today at leftfieldinvestors.com/BEC, and we will see you at Passive Investing with Left Field Investors at the BEC. Wow. I don't even know where to start. That was just, I was being educated the entire time, and I loved it. He's just got so much information to share, and he talked about, you know, how he wanted to be a history teacher. Well, I think the first half of that was a history lesson, and it was fantastic. I've heard some of that before, but to get it all in one dose of how, you know, all these resets is phenomenal. I just really loved it. Selfishly, you know, I'll listen to this a few times, and this is why I love doing the podcast, because I get to talk to people like Russell Gray. Are you kidding me? Some of the things that really hit with me, other than all of it, was, you know, he says you want to try to work in a business that has a purpose and is a labor of love. And I just like that. It pays off. You can tell he enjoys this stuff. He knows this stuff. And that just comes through. And that really does make a difference, right? Some people say, well, you want to have hobbies. You don't want to work in your hobby. But when you get so passionate about something and you can make money off it and you can help other people, wow, that's just, I don't know if that's the trifecta or more, but Russ has it and he shared us that with us. And so I'm so thankful for that. And then, you know, we talk about learning from mistakes. I mean, Steve Sue wrote the book, Avoiding Rookie Errors as a Left Field Investor, right? It was all about learning from his mistakes. But you also understand the macro and you combine those two is what Russell is saying is you learn from your mistakes and then you also try to understand the macro, try to understand the big picture of what's going on and you will have some success. And then if it wasn't clear, Russell Gray is not a fan of Wall Street, which, you know, I get it. Wall Street, they don't want to educate you, right? They want to sell to you. And that's different. And that's why we're in the alternative space. I don't know why it's called alternative, but it is investing in real assets, as he said, that produce real income. I mean, that's one of our taglines in at Left Field Investors, because that's what we want to do. And Wall Street, you know, you're not in it as much. You're not as close to it. You can't talk to the you know, the presidents or CEOs. You can't talk to Tim Cook from Apple, right? But you can talk to the operator of your syndication. So I agree with Russell on a lot of that, that Wall Street, you know, there's better places to be, obviously, and that's where we all are. And then, man, the analogy with the quarter and the gallon of gas, I remember hearing the similar analogy with a suit, right? If you have an ounce of gold, you know, in the before times, you could buy a toga, that same ounce of gold will buy you a suit today. But I like the analogy with a quarter and a gallon of gas. You have a 1964 quarter that today will buy you a gallon of gas, but the 1965 quarter, you know, it'll buy you, what do you say, a 20th, yeah, whatever the gas price is, a 20th of a gallon of gas. And so he's trying to show you that these metals, they hold their value. And so having some of that in your portfolio is a good idea. It's fallen out of favor, but I think having a little bit of that in there makes sense. And then again, talking about interest rates, the issue is not that the rate is 5, 6, 7% or 18% or whatever. It's the rate of change. And the example he gave, right? If you're going from 8 to 16%, you've doubled. But if you're going from 0.25 to 5%, man, that's 20 times. That's a lot. So that is the issue we're having, is the rate of change and the impact that has, not just on the syndications that we've invested in, but also the government, right? Because they're issuing debt and they have to make these payments and their costs have gone up. So that's just a cascading waterfall of problems. And then he talked about income is equity, because as you're taking income, you're building equity, right? That goes right into your pocket. So I just love that. And then finally, I think the most powerful thing, or one of the most powerful things he said, was being an LP, right? Being a limited partner, it does not mean you're passive, because you have to be active. He talked about all the things you need to dig into and understand and why it makes sense, right? We don't really get education on finance, and that's why we have communities like Left Field Investors or the Real Estate Guys, right? They are so passionate about education. And being an LP doesn't mean you just sit back and invest in things willy-nilly. I know I kind of started out that way, but I really try to dig in and understand things more. And that's what he's talking about, is you're not just passive, you are an active investor, meaning you are actively taking charge of your own situation. You're actively analyzing the deals. You know, we use a community to help us out, and that's perfect, right? That's still active. So when we talk about passive investing, we mean, okay, yes, we're passive once we send the wire, but before that, we got to be active. We got to do a better job of really digging in, analyzing, and understanding these deals. And that's why we have this community, so we can work together at that. Again, this episode went longer than intended, but I used every single minute of Russell's time that was allocated to us. So I'm super happy about that. Really, really enjoyed talking to Russell. And, you know, I had probably 15 questions and I think I asked him three of them. So we will definitely try to get him back on. He's a busy guy, but we will try to get him back on the show at some point, because this was fantastic. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And we'll catch you next time in the left field. Thanks for hanging out in the left field with us today. If you are interested in becoming a left fielder, you can find us on the World Wide Web at www.leftfieldinvestor.com and click the subscribe button to join our community. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the show on your podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you really enjoyed the show, a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts would be appreciated.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said on the show should be considered financial advice. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Passive Investing from Left Field and Left Field Investors. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.